I sighed, and the words friendly fire flashed through my mind. Homer, we've got 6 busters left, and the 2 Brazilians have 4 missiles each if they're provisioned the same as the 4 we just destroyed. Not only can we not do the pairing up thing to defend against the missiles, but we don't have enough busters to take out the missiles and the ships, even if our luck is perfect. So I'm going to try to rebuild some busters, and I'm going to scoop up a bunch of scrap from the battle as well for railgun ammo. You might want to do the same. Homer looked thoughtful for a moment, then nodded. Phase 2 of the assault involved sneaking up on the 2 remaining Brazilian ships. We had deliberately chosen an approach around the sun that would require us to come around the other side at full 2.5G acceleration in order to get to Earth. And we had been very careful not to display our full 5G capability since coming in system. Now we applied every erg of power to bending our course before we came around from behind the sun.
Shut down in 5 seconds.
I shut down my VR. In a few seconds, both ships would go dark. We would shut down the surge drives and go ballistic. We would stop using SUDAR and shut down the fusion reactors. As far as the Brazilian ships would know, we and our pursuers had annihilated each other. When they didn't see us come out the other side on the expected trajectory, hopefully they would relax their guard. For 2 days, we would drift, surviving on power cells. We would lower our frame rates to minimum in order to save every milliwatt of power. The roamers would be set to refining the scraps from the battle into cannonballs for the railgun. But as each roamer ran its power cell down, it would be shelved. We would power up only when we had put Earth directly between us and the Brazilians.
Shut down.
I felt the ship go dark. I cranked my frame rate all the way down.
We have arrived.
Report.
Orbital insertion was successful. We are coming up on a point directly on the other side of Earth from the enemy ships.
Excellent. As soon as we're sufficiently shielded, start everything up and accelerate to keep us in their blind spot.
Aye.
As power came up to full, I restarted my VR and relaxed into my captain's chair. Homer popped up in a video window.
I see you survived the trip.
I nodded to him. Let's get the mission status up in the tank, Guppy. The holotank filled with a schematic showing the Earth, the location of our ships, and the location of the 2 Brazilian ships, and the 4 asteroid masses that they were shepherding.
Positions of enemy are extrapolations, but are high probability, based on orbital mechanics and most recent observations.
That's fine, Guppy. Our biggest problem will be if the Brazilians play hide-and-seek behind the asteroids that they're herding. If they fire their missiles from hiding, they won't have a lock-in, and we'll have to depend on the missile's AMI, which we've already established is not very smart. We can set our busters to seek and destroy, but they don't have explosive warheads. Without a good head of steam, they won't be able to penetrate the hull, let alone do any internal damage.
If we're that close, we can use railguns,
Homer said. True, but we have to be careful with our ammo. We came around the Earth already doing over 150 kilometers a second. The Brazilian ships might or might not have noticed us right away, but they had 6 hours to see us and prepare for our arrival. We were still only revealing a maximum 2.5G acceleration. Let them expend energy wondering how we managed to get behind Earth. When we were still 5 minutes away from the lead asteroid, we received a hail from one of the Brazilian ships. I put the call up on the holotank while Homer observed. The video was a still image of the Brazilian flag. No avatar, I guess.
You have shown better than we expected from a couple of faith babacas. However, now you are coming to us. You will not be so lucky this time. We will litter space with your corpses.
I looked at Homer in surprise. That's not Major Medeiros. Who is that? This is Commander Riker of the Faith Space Navy. To whom am I speaking?
I am Captain Matthias Araujo. I will be the last voice you hear.
Without further commentary, the sender disconnected. Homer and I exchanged looks. After a pause, Homer said,
So what do you think is going on?
I thought about it for a moment. I don't know. but that deep scan I did just before we destroyed our pursuers showed all fabrication systems had been removed to make room for the larger surge-based missiles. I didn't think that through at the time, but now it looks like this may have been a last-ditch effort on the part of the Brazilian Empire. Maybe they were getting stomped and the probe project was all they had left. They volunteered some guy, someone disposable, stuck his replicant into the ships and tried to use them as gunships. Hummer cocked his head.
Which might mean they didn't have time to give this guy a lot of training in being a replicant, and these ships may be all that's left of the war.
Missiles launched.
We checked our telemetry. The Brazilians had launched 8 missiles.
Damn. Exactly what we hoped they wouldn't do, Hummer said. Guess they aren't that inexperienced.
Or they're just pissed. Or they have more missiles. However, their timing is terrible. They waited too long, and we're now close enough to use the asteroids. Follow my lead. Instead of launching countermeasures or attempting to flee, we did a hard turn and dove down below the asteroid. As soon as we were out of line of sight, we fired a load of smaller metal detritus from our aft railguns at a speed that left the space junk at a dead stop in our wake. As the pursuing missiles came around the end of the asteroid, they ran head-on into the stationary flotsam. 3 missiles detonated immediately, which, unfortunately, cleared the junk for the trailing missiles. Watch forward while I take out the rest of this batch, I said to Homer. As I was preparing my busters for launch, Homer said,
Launches from up front. Looks like they had more missiles. I think we're screwed.
I spared a millisecond to review the situation. I had 5 missiles coming in from the rear. I could take 2 out, possibly 3, with the railgun. Homer had 8 missiles coming in from the front. That meant 13 missiles against 11 busters, to say nothing of the Brazilian ships, which we would still need to deal with. It was very likely that the Brazilians had used everything they had by this point. We were far too close to them for any further missile play.
We have to cut the numbers of the frontal attack. I'll give you all my busters. Save 2.
Try to knock as many out with shrapnel as you can. I launched all my busters and handed control of 5 over to Homer, who sent them forward. I concentrated on the 5 missiles coming up from behind me, sending wave after wave of junk into their path. I had destroyed 2 when I realized that 2 of the 3 remaining missiles had crowded together trying to avoid a volley. I immediately sent a buster toward the nearest one at full acceleration. There was a flash, and both the missile and the buster were destroyed, but yes, the other missile had been knocked out by the explosion. It was drifting aimlessly.
They're getting a little close,
Homer said.
Little help? Any time?
Almost done. Hold tight. As I sent a huge wave of shrapnel at the final missile, Homer yelped,
Crap!
And his signal went dead. I split my attention between my 1 missile and Homer's battlefield. Homer had taken out almost all of his missiles, but 1 had exploded far too close. It appeared to have damaged, but not obliterated, Heaven 6. However, the ship was adrift with everything offline. A couple of busters had circled around and chased the 2 final missiles from the front, but only 1 was anywhere near close enough to do any good. At that moment, a flash from aft indicated that my last volley had taken out the 1 remaining chase missile. That left me with 1 extra buster, but I wouldn't be able to get around to the front in time. They're not very smart. The thought came from nowhere, seemingly irrelevant, but original Bob had always trusted his hunches, and I reacted immediately. I fired a salvo of shrapnel, not directly at a missile, but just to the side opposite the pursuing buster. In true reflex action, the missile veered away from the shrapnel stream. That was all the buster needed to catch up. I was now able to concentrate a burst of shrapnel on the other missile and take it out. I looked back to the 1 missile left, the one that my buster had caught up with, and realized I had a problem. The busters depended on kinetic energy to destroy their targets. High-speed ramming, basically. This buster had instead run down a missile that was just as fast as itself. Now the buster and missile were flying together, with the buster repeatedly and ineffectually bumping the missile. It was interfering with the missile's trajectory, but not causing any damage.
Stop trying to have sex with it, idiot!
I sent a command to the buster, causing its reactor to fail catastrophically. The release of plasma and energy was more than enough to liquefy both units. I did a quick inventory. I had 2 busters left, and 2 enemies. There was no time to deal with Homer at the moment. I called the busters home and did a full ping, trying to locate the Brazilian ships. One of them was less than 2 seconds away, heading right for me. With a jolt, I realized he intended to ram. With no time for a formal calculation, I had to wing it. I accelerated upward at a full 5G. Either the Brazilian would be able to turn to intercept, or he wouldn't. 2 seconds later, the Brazilian passed by my stern, still attempting to change course, and 2 milliseconds after that, a buster passed through the Brazilian craft, right where the computer core was located. The Brazilian craft's drive turned off, and it began to drift. I pinged again, but got no return from the last ship. Either the ship had been destroyed in some unknown manner, or it was hiding behind one of the asteroids. We had shown our hands during the battle, so the Brazilian would know that it couldn't win a straight foot race. That meant it was hiding, hoping to keep the asteroid between us. I was out of railgun ammo. I had one buster left, but the buster wasn't going to be much good if it had to chase the Brazilian around the asteroid. I examined the return from my last ping and spotted what I'd been hoping for, the steel ball from one of the defunct busters. I sent out a couple of roamers, collected it, and loaded it into the railgun. The steel balls had been deliberately sized so that they could double as railgun ammo. I sent the buster out at an angle that should give it a clear view of the other side of the nearest asteroid. Sure enough, remote telemetry spotted the Brazilian ship just as he spotted the buster. He took off around the asteroid in the opposite direction. Bangarang, mofo! It took a millisecond to calculate his trajectory. I sent the ball off at full acceleration just as the enemy vessel came into sight. The Brazilian had no chance at all. The steel ball, backed by the full power of my railgun, punched through the ship at close to relativistic speed. The impact literally tore the ship in two, imparting opposite spins on each half as they drifted away. There was a flash as the reactor lost containment and one of the segments slumped and deformed from the centrifugal force. That's for Homer. My roamers sent back detailed views as they investigated Heaven 6. Homer appeared to have been very lucky. A fluke piece of shrapnel had cut off power to his computer core. Though there was significant structural damage, the actual core systems were intact. The reactor had been able to effect a graceful emergency shutdown when control disappeared. One of the purposes of the roamers was to repair and maintain the Heaven vessels, and I activated that program for Homer's roamers. Pfft, Homer's roamers, jeez, I'm starting to sound like him. It occurred to me that I could now decorate my hull as Bob One had. 3 for me, 3 for Homer. Better make that a priority. I had several tasks on the go. While some roamers worked on Heaven 6, others investigated the asteroids to find out how the Brazilians guided them, and a third group collected flotsam from the area of the battle. Raw materials were free for the taking in asteroids, but already refined material was well worth the trouble of scavenging. The Brazilian hulks in particular would be good for a lot of salvageable material. The second group of roamers began to report back, and I examined the scans as they came in. The asteroids, it turned out, were being chivvied by a low-intensity wide-field surge drive. The design ensured that the entire asteroid could be accelerated as a unit, without tidal forces or field drop-off tearing the body apart. It was an ingenious system, and I took copious scans for transmission to Bill. If he hadn't already started moving Kuiper bodies toward Ragnarok, these designs would be very helpful. Which was all very interesting, but the asteroids were still heading for Earth. If these bodies all struck the planet, even bacteria wouldn't survive the results. The Brazilians had set up the trajectory near perfectly, and there was no chance of a miss. I had to hope that I could impart enough sideways thrust on the asteroids using their surge drives to change that. But first, I had to get them to obey me, and I didn't have the encryption keys that the Brazilians had been using to transmit commands to the asteroid drives. Well, easily fixed. I ordered the roamers to simply rip the drive controllers out and hotwire the drive systems. No finesse or delicate electronics was required for a straight full-power sideways thrust. It remained to be seen if I was starting too late. Wake up, buddy. You okay?
NTM, NTM!
Homer's VR came online, smiling.
I guess we got him.
I snorted with relief. And their little dog, too. Homer steepled his fingers in a properly evil mastermindish pose.
All their base are belong to us.
We laughed together, maybe the first time since Homer had been born that we'd been in sync like that. I had a sudden jolt of what might be described as fatherly pride. Okay, that's weird. Snap out of it. Homer waved a hand in a vague out there gesture.
So what do we have?
I'm still evaluating, and by the way, in case you haven't checked, your back is still broken, so don't be trying to fly anywhere just yet. Guppy estimates 3 more days to get you shipshape. Homer bobbed his head, and I continued. The signs of war are everywhere. Nukes were definitely used, both planet-side and space-side, and I mean a lot. It looks like everyone just went toe-to-toe and started throwing punches until only one side was left standing. As far as I can tell, the only technological force left in the whole system was a small group of Brazilian probes that had been modified for war. I found the manufacturing area. It had broken down, and the Araujos couldn't repair it because they hadn't been loaded with the auto factory software or equipment. They couldn't land and bring someone upstairs to fix it. Not that I'm sure there's anyone left to do it anyway. And they couldn't build a lander or shuttle because no auto factory. Classic Catch-22.
So they were doing what, running around smashing things instead?
Homer grimaced. Pretty much. Taking revenge on their enemies. The asteroids had all been timed to target China, so I'm guessing that's who took out the Brazilian Empire.
Took out? How bad?
Pretty bad. It's actually kind of hard to tell exactly how much damage there is because of all the cloud and dust cover. Asteroid strikes and nukes kicked up a lot of dust, and it's just trashed the weather patterns.
There were other asteroid strikes? These weren't the first?
No, not by a long shot. But these were the biggest, I think. I've been able to make out dozens of impact sites, most around the size of the Barringer crater. These 4 would have been extinction level, Yucatan crater size.
4 of them?
Yeah. I shook my head in disbelief. I can't believe anyone would think that this was a reasonable response to anything. I feel no regret or guilt for ending those guys.
Is anyone left on Earth?
I put a globe of the Earth up in the holotank and sent a copy to Homer. I haven't been able to pick up any radio transmissions or reactor signatures, but then you wouldn't expect anyone to want to attract attention. I'm sure the Araujo gang dropped a rock on anyone they detected. By now, everyone still alive has gone to ground. Homer rubbed his forehead, his eyes unfocused.
What'll we do? I guess we could transmit an announcement, but some might just see that as a trick.
He idly poked a finger at his copy of the globe and spun it to show different views. He sat back after a few seconds, then put his hand to his chin and resumed staring into space. I waited, content to let him work through whatever he was wrestling with. Finally, he looked up.
We can use SUDAR, to a certain extent, but atmosphere and planetary mass will play hell with the resolution. What about the exploration scouts that Bill came up with?
Funny you should ask, I responded with a smile. I'm building some as fast as I can. I stopped smiling and continued in a more serious tone. We need to sweep for surviving groups as quickly as possible. Between the nukes that were used and the rocks that were dropped, Earth looks like it might be spiraling into a nuclear winter. Anyone still alive might starve to death over the next couple of years.
But what will we be able to do if we find survivors?
I don't know, Homer. I shook my head, reluctant to meet his gaze. We're going to have to take this one step at a time. We watched as the 4th and last asteroid slid past the Earth. Although we'd known for a while that they would miss, this was an emotional moment. The original drive controllers had been replaced with more cooperative hardware, which was now programmed to gradually push the asteroids into long-period orbits with a high inclination that wouldn't intersect Earth's orbit in the future.
One less thing to worry about,
Homer said with a smile.
We are being hailed.
We looked at each other in surprise. What now? 25. Bill, September 2151, Epsilon Eridani.
All that's really missing is a good artificial intelligence to control the whole process. And that's the trick, isn't it? These types of blue-sky discussions always assume certain advances for a successful implementation. Unfortunately, AI is the bottleneck in this case. We are close with the replication and manufacturing processes, and we could probably build sufficiently effective ion drives if we had the budget. But we lack a way to provide enough intelligence for the probe to handle all the situations that it could face.
Edward Guipers, from the convention panel, Designing a von Neumann Probe. I listened carefully to the telemetry coming over the radio link. Garfield was over 5 light-minutes away and receding at a respectable 2,000 kilometers per second. The time signal in his telemetry fell behind at a steady, predictable rate. Well, I hadn't really expected to prove old Einstein wrong at this late date. It was the other signal that I was excited about. I was receiving a subspace signal from Garfield that originated with the same telemetry, transmitted at the same time, but the time stamp on that signal still exactly synchronized with mine to the limit of accuracy of our systems. I could tell I was grinning like an idiot. VR had long since become so realistic that it might as well have been real life, and that included aching facial muscles. Okay, Garfield, radio telemetry has you coming up on 6 light-minutes away. Can you confirm my echo?
Yep. The return is just over 11.5 minutes behind my transmission.
Garfield's voice held the same excitement. He'd been working with me for several years now on multiple projects, including this one. We turned into a regular skunk works, and this was our biggest breakthrough by far. Cut the transceiver loose, Garfield, and come on back. We'll let the unit continue outbound for a few weeks and see what the dropout is like.
No problem.
Without warning, Garfield popped up in my VR, sitting in his beanbag chair. I jumped.
How the hell?
He laughed at my reaction.
Ha! One up, you old man. Take that.
You integrated the VR into the subspace comms? I felt a slow smile spread across my face. That was pretty impressive work. His bobbing eyebrows were answer enough. Then he frowned and thought,
this tech isn't going to make the space stations obsolete, is it?
Not a chance, I shook my head. We'll have to wait until someone builds one at the other end, but theory says the signal dropout will be almost total after about 25 light years. We'll have to use the space stations as routers.
The internet goes galactic, Garfield laughed.
Hey, with IPv8, we should be able to address every galaxy in the universe. I knew I was preaching to the choir. After all, Bob, right? But I have a tendency to think out loud.
That's fine, Bill. When do you think we'll be ready to transmit plans?
I think we should send what we have right now. It's still clunky, but once they've built it at the other end, they don't have to wait years for the next update. We grinned at each other across the virtual table. This changed everything.
26. Riker, April 2157, Sol. The signal was audio only and very weak.
Unknown ship, do you copy?
I looked at Homer and raised one eyebrow. He shrugged.
As good a place to start as any.
Activating my transmitter, I responded. This is the starship Heaven 2 of the United Federation of Planets, Commander Riker speaking. There were several seconds of silence.
Uh-huh. Listen, I don't know who you are, but you've just apparently averted a global catastrophe, so I guess I'm willing to give you the benefit of the doubt. Our telemetry is not up to military snuff, but our systems tentatively identify you as similar to the Heaven Series interstellar probe that Faith launched a couple or three decades back.
Guilty as charged. And to whom am I speaking?
I am Colonel George Butterworth of the United States of Eurasia Army Corps. Rest assured, Commander, that our true position is obfuscated. If you attempt to destroy the source of this transmission, you will achieve nothing.
The Colonel's accent was definitely British and far too close to the cliched pronunciation portrayed in many American TV shows. I would have to be careful not to let Homer talk to him. I doubted Homer would be able to resist the urge toward mimicry. Colonel, let's not get off on the wrong foot, okay? We have no intention of blowing anyone up. We had a little disagreement with what appears to have been the last of the Brazilian Empire Space Navy. Now, I think it's time to start fixing things. We had been in discussions with the USE military for 3 weeks now. I was faithfully forwarding recordings of everything to Bill. Negotiations were slow and cautious, mostly on the part of Colonel Butterworth. He had been very slow to accept the idea that Homer and I weren't dyed-in-the-wool faith theologues. It took a very frank discussion in which I explained in detail the reasons for my atheism before the Colonel really began to believe me. The USC refugee camp that Colonel Butterworth had under his care consisted of about 20,000 people, mostly civilians, who had been collected into an underground military installation when the space bombardments had started. The Colonel guessed the global human population at less than 20 million at this point, although he admitted the uncertainty on that estimate was huge. Some of the refugees were scientific personnel who had been working on a USC colony ship back before the war. In the 22nd century, things were constructed in virtual space, first. Once complete, the plans were uploaded to an auto factory which built the entire item using 3D printers, roamers, and nanites. The colony ship plans were ready, needing only a space-based construction yard and a destination. The colonel informed us that the Chinese and USC probes had launched shortly after Bob 1, but the USC probe had never been heard from again. The colonel and I were conversing via video link, as usual. He knew that the Heaven vessels were staffed by replicants, as were the USC and Brazilian probes. However, we were the first to have a full-on VR avatar that looked and behaved like a human being. The colonel was having a little trouble accepting at a visceral level that I wasn't real. I toned down the Enterprise theme and stopped making Star Trek references out of courtesy. It blew me away that almost 200 years after Shatner first famously didn't actually say, "Beam me up, Scotty," people still knew Star Trek. Now that's a franchise. At the moment, the colonel was bringing me up to date on recent history. If we were going to make an attempt to save the human race, I wanted to have the whole picture.
"There was never actually a point where you could say, 'Now we're at war,'" the colonel explained. "International tensions had been high for quite a number of years. The confrontation over the attempted destruction of Heaven 1 was simply the tipping point. Each act prompted a reaction, each reaction a retaliation. The other governments got dragged in one at a time, and eventually it became system-wide. Stations and colonies were abandoned, personnel were recalled. Some of the transports were destroyed, despite having no military value. Of course, that just escalated things." The colonel got up and began to pace around his office. The camera at his end kept him perfectly framed. "At first, the conflict was primarily space-side. Annexation of strategic locations and orbits, denial of assets, that kind of thing. Then the first nuke was used planet-side. And after that, all bets were off." Colonel Butterworth sat down at his desk and massaged his forehead for a few moments. He reached into a drawer and pulled out what looked very much like a bottle of Jameson. Funny what survives the end of the world. After pouring a glass and taking a sip, he continued, "It became a war of attrition. Each side tried to neutralize the other's military capability. Then someone nuked most of the Brazilian Empire. Your theory that it was the Chinese is reasonable, and civilian targets became fair game. The ships you took out were the last men standing. Metaphorically speaking, of course, they were only replicants." The colonel blushed slightly. No offense meant. In any case, they wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes at the height of the war when everyone still had equipment, but here at the end we had no way to stop them. They just started slowly pounding away at everyone. Call it a scorched earth policy. Call it revenge, whatever. It was genocide. They probably took out a couple of billion people on their own."
I felt ill. I had waited an additional 6 months while Homer and the decoy were assembled. How many people had died for that delay? The colonel had reached the end of his spiel and was concentrating on the glass of Jameson. "So what can we do, Colonel? Help rebuild? Relocate people?"
"I think that ship has sailed, Commander. The Earth will recover eventually. It's tough that way, but not in time for humanity. My tame scientists say it will be minimum 5 to 10,000 years before things recover to any degree. We won't last that long.
Colonel Butterworth touched a control, and a schematic popped up in the video link.
This is the colony ship we designed and started to build in hopes that our probes would report back with something worth shipping out to. One of the first casualties of the war, I'm afraid. You have on board auto factories that can bootstrap up to a full shipyard. With your help, we'd like to build a couple of these and leave the solar system.
And go where, specifically? The colonel sighed.
I'm actually hoping you'll suggest a destination. It's not like Faith is going to be sending any ships. And you gave me to believe that you have no particular loyalty there.
And that's true, Colonel. I'm just making sure we're all on the same wavelength. I popped up a star chart of everything within 20 light-years of Earth. You can see the stars rated for likelihood of a habitable planet. Unfortunately, Epsilon Eridani was a failure, unless you want to live under a dome. By now, Bill may have received reports back from a couple of our ships, but we won't find out for a few more years. Can you last that long?
We have to. It'll take most of a decade to go from a standing start to 2 colony ships.
I nodded. Okay, then. Let's get this show on the road. 27. Bob, April 2165, Delta Eridani. I patted Spike as I watched the image of the planet slowly build in the holotank. To one side, a schematic of the entire system slowly cycled the planets through their orbits. I couldn't keep a grin off my face. Space exploration was fully living up to my nerd fantasies. Flying into a new star system, never before seen by humans, was a heady, almost godlike experience. I still couldn't get over the idea that Bill was willing to sit in one system. On the other hand, he would get a chance to do physics and engineering full-time, and he'd be getting regular reports from everyone, albeit at light speed, so he would be participating, at least vicariously. I hoped he'd forward any interesting news to the rest of us. Delta Eridani was an orange star, cooler than Sol, but more than 2.5 times as big. I had deliberately picked this system as my destination because of the high level of suitability. No binary companion, not a flare or variable star, exceptionally long-living stellar type, low in UV emissions, wide potential habitable zone, the list went on and on. The results fully lived up to expectations. I had identified 10 planets, including one in the inner half of the comfort zone. The layout of this system paralleled the Sol system to the point where I suspected there was some universal law at work. The inner planets were all rocky worlds, while the outer were all gas giants, and an asteroid belt divided the two groups. This system, though, contained 5 inner rocky planets, and 2 of the 5 outer gas giants had rings that rivaled Saturn's. The biggest, Jovian, was just stupid big, at about 6 times the mass of Jupiter. I hadn't yet counted all the moons it had collected. And because of the size of their sun, the planets were more spread out, which might explain the large number of moons. Only the innermost planet was missing its own satellite. I was too impatient to follow mission protocol and scan for resources first. I made a beeline for the habitable planet and did a quick survey from orbit. I would take the time to evaluate the results while I did the required but boring raw materials search. Soon, I had completed the orbital scan. I did a quick flyby of the 2 moons. Then, with a sigh, I ordered Guppy to begin the survey of the asteroid belt. Status?
Asteroid belt scan 50% completed. 6 locations identified with significant ore suitable for mining.
At only halfway around? That's pretty good.
Significantly better than Epsilon Eridani or Sol.
I nodded, then turned back to one of my infrared images of the night side of Delta Eridani 4, taken during the orbital survey. Hey, Guppy, look at this here. I materialized an arrow and pointed it to a spot on the picture where several points of light were recorded. Do these look like fires to you?
Probability very high.
You think they're natural? Wildfires?
I am not programmed to have an opinion.
Oh, good Lord. Okay. Then analysis.
List the possible explanations in order of likelihood.
Small local wildfires would be most likely, except...
Yes. Guppy was about to volunteer information. That was definitely a first.
No indication of lightning storms in the area, and the fires do not appear to be spreading. Further investigation is required.
Ha! No argument from me there. Let's get this survey out of the way.
And get the auto factory set up.
Nag, nag. I sat back, bemused, and stared at the slowly rotating planetary image. The survey was soon finished. I flew back to the location of the biggest deposits and began to set up. I unshipped the manufacturing equipment, sent mining roamers to work on the most promising asteroids, and deployed transport drones. I decided that defense was going to be a priority, starting with an early warning system. Accordingly, I manufactured 12 observation drones and sent them to form an icosahedron around the system. With small shielded reactors, they would spot any incoming craft long before it could possibly detect one of them. Next came the communications station. That routine task could be left to the AMIs. I gave them instructions for construction of the station and further instructions to get started on building Bob's. At some point, I would need to get involved again, but for now, I could leave my devices to their own devices. Snickering at my own wordplay, I headed back to DE4. I dreaded building more Bob's. Just a bit. The first cohort had been a surprise, and not a pleasant one. Milo's self-centeredness had surprised all of us, and although I hadn't said anything to anyone about it, Riker's lack of a sense of humor had bothered me. When I made more Bob's, would I end up with a psychopath? Okay, that was a little over the top. The differences between the Bob's weren't that dramatic. My parents would probably have recognized me in any of them. Mario, for instance, when I was in a situation that I was impatient with, I clammed up just like that. Just maybe not to that extent. All beside the point, though, Bill was right. I would, sooner or later, want company. On the trip out from Epsilon Eridani, I had worked on designs for exploration drones. Bill said he would work on the concept, but I wanted something usable when I got here. If Bill sent along some plans at some point, I'd merge the best of both. Meanwhile, I was at least able to operate. The observation drones were about the size of footballs. They came with remote cameras and microphones, as well as extendable limbs for gripping and perching. More than anything, they reminded me of very large pill bugs. I started on the biological analysis drones as well. They were larger, about a meter in length. They had visual and auditory input optimized for more close-up work, and they had a far larger number of extendable appendages for various tasks. I suppose I could have waited to deploy everything at once, but I simply didn't have that level of patience. The drones could change color to match the background, even to the extent of some limited pattern mimicry. When in the air, they would adjust their bottom half to match the sky and their upper half to match the general terrain. This wasn't out of any fear of getting shot down, more of a concern about some local wildlife attempting to make a meal out of one. The drones were pretty tough, but why borrow trouble? I sent several observation drones to the general area of the fires. As a city boy, I didn't have a true appreciation of how big thousands of square miles of wilderness actually was. This area of the planet was temperate to subtropical forest. Well, I assumed it was forest. Whatever it was, it stretched from horizon to horizon, with occasional breaks for meadows and rocky bluffs. Truthfully, someone flying a small airplane over this wouldn't have been able to tell they weren't on Earth. I felt a momentary pang of homesickness. I realized there was no way I could find anything with a random search. It was late afternoon in this area, so I sent one drone up a kilometer and instructed it to wait for nightfall and look for fires. I sent the other drone down to examine the forest ecosystem close up. The planet was slightly larger than Earth, but had a lower surface gravity, probably due to a smaller core. The gravity, combined with a somewhat denser atmosphere, made for an environment ideal for soaring flyers and tall tree analogs. And the trees had taken advantage of this. The drone landed in a tree, extended its legs, and began to slowly creep along the trunk, and I realized with a start it was really a tree. It was brown, well, brownish, tall, hard, and had branches and leafy things. It looked like a pretty clear case of convergent evolution. It was, in fact, the kind of tree that I loved to climb when I was young. Wide horizontal branchings produced many convenient places to sit. Thick leaf canopies kept the sun off, and the sheer size of the trees was awe-inspiring. I wanted to hug one. The canopy was awash with life. The drone, camouflaged to resemble the tree bark, could snoop on the local wildlife with impunity. I had done an intensive study of taxonomy and cladistics analysis during the voyage, and now found myself evaluating the images with a semi-professional eye. Although the body plans varied wildly in their details, the creatures I was seeing did tend to fall into familiar patterns. Insect analogs were, so far, six-legged and exoskeletal, and seemed to hit a maximum size of slightly larger than a mouse. I found a small furry mammal analog that had six legs as well, except for one variant that had four legs and wings. I decided to name this particular animal a hippogriff, harkening back to my D&D days. This particular little beastie seemed to have limited ability to change color, to match its background. I watched with amazement as it blended into the tree branch and waited for prey to pass by. I also cataloged many larger mammal analogs that had four limbs. They might be an evolutionary branch that had lost the third pair. And there were birds, or again, bird analogs. The bird analogs had what looked very much like feathers. I found it fascinating that the bird things flew like birds and the small furry things flew like bats. It seemed that aerodynamics had a lot to say about animal flight here, just as on Earth. There was even a snake equivalent, which interestingly seemed to be mammalian on this planet. It looked like the three-segment body plan had been multiplied to considerable length. I found everything fascinating and was paradoxically irritated when Guppy interrupted.
Heat and light sources detected.
A schematic popped up on the holotank. All right, multiples. Have the drones set up as close as they can while remaining hidden. Let's see what we've got. Deployment took about half an hour. The drones needed to be careful not to attract attention by rattling the vegetation or banging into things. They needed to find a good place of concealment using night vision, which was notoriously subpar for detail work. Eventually, though, the units were in position. Surveillance from several different vantage points showed groups of animals gathered around fires. No, not animals. Beings. Some of the beings were tending the fires, while others seemed to be handling small objects in purposeful ways. While it was far too soon to form any detailed conclusions, I was pretty certain that these were, at minimum, fire users.
Well, that's it for this planet as a colonization target, I guess.
I held my fists in the air in triumph. I'd just discovered intelligent, non-human life. Not technological yet, but so what? This was huge! I wondered if I had first contact dibs. I would have to send a message off to Bill soonest. The natives were not pretty from a human-centric perspective. I decided that the best description would be a bat-pig mashup. Limbs were longer than seemed reasonable, giving them a spiderish appearance. They had a light coat of fur, which varied in color from a light brownish gray to an orangey tan. The faces and heads had varied color patterns, topped by a pair of very mobile and expressive ears. The rest of the body tended to be monochromatic. I kept up a running stream of commentary for my reports to Bill. I smiled to myself as I pictured him as a spider, sitting in the center of his web, listening to the vibrations on the various strands. I can see a couple of infants nursing at an adult's breast. I don't want to make assumptions, but I guess if it's for nursing, it's a breast. I can't assume it's milk either, although it's a pretty safe bet that it's for nourishment. I also can't assume that the adult is a female or that it's the child's parent. I'm tentatively assigning tags to each individual based on their fur patterns. I looked over at Guppy, who stood at the ready. While I wasn't an expert on reading fish expressions, I thought I detected occasional interest in my observations. I hoped so. For all the joy of having the universe as my playground, I had to admit that it was lonely. I took a deep breath and resumed my verbal annotations. There are 6 groups, each of which maintains its own fire. They seem friendly, and there is frequent interaction between individual members, but the groups seem to remain distinct. I've instructed one of the drones to get in close enough to pick up sounds. I'm pretty sure they're talking to each other. I turned to Guppy. Any problem with sending roamers down?
Roamers are not intended as exploration units.
That doesn't answer my question. Guppy rolled his eyes. Guppy actually rolled his eyes. Rolling eyes on a giant fish head were truly epic.
Roamers are not designed for exploration on planetary surfaces. Although they have the capability, they would not be maximally efficient. Cameras are small aperture and designed for close-in work. Auditory sensitivity is rudimentary. There is no infrared capability. They have no flight capability and would not be able to camouflage themselves.
Damn, good answer. Okay, Guppy, thanks.
I exist to serve.
I laughed out loud. No one was going to convince me that wasn't sarcasm. Great poker face, though. 28. Calvin, November 2163, Alpha Centauri. Thus, what is of supreme importance in war is to attack the enemy's strategy. Sun Tzu, Art of War. Alpha Centauri B was more orange than Sol and less than half the luminosity, therefore less than ideal as a possible home for humanity. Goku had won rock, paper, scissors for choice, so he got A, and I got the dud. I coasted through the system in freefall, nuclear reactor throttled down to an undetectable trickle, passive detection systems at full alert. I was down near my lowest frame rate. From this extremely slowed viewpoint, the star system seemed to flow by. We had spent a lot of time planning the investigation of the Alpha Centauri system. This was the obvious first stop for a space probe, and it was likely that several of the other superpowers had chosen it as their first destination. After much discussion, we had decided on a reconnaissance of Alpha Centauri A and B by running silent all the way through the systems. Investigating the actual planetary layout was a secondary priority, but unless something dangerous showed up, I was free to use passive observation techniques to map orbiting bodies. So far, Alpha Centauri B was no big deal. I'd identified one planet and an asteroid belt, but I still wasn't close enough to the inner system to resolve the comfort zone. I ejected 2 scouts using the railgun. They had orders to activate at staggered distances with random vectors so that an observer wouldn't be able to backtrack their trajectory to my location. The scouts were equipped with a modified SUDAR array based on Bill's early research back in Epsilon Eridani. The new system could adjust its range to up to 3 light hours, albeit with much reduced resolution. The survey results were disappointing. The comfort zone contained a second asteroid belt, and there was a small Mercury-like planet in an inner orbit. It seemed there had been very little planetary formation, probably due to the close orbit of the 2 suns. A stable planetary orbit was unlikely outside of 3 AU or so. More importantly, from the point of view of the mission, there had been no attack and no in-system reactor activation. I allowed the scouts to range through the system, checking out the asteroid belt for anything interesting. If nothing else, I would set up an auto factory here, if the resources could be found.
Found something interesting.
Finally, I was ready to go catatonic. What have we got, Guppy?
Wreckage. 20 light minutes spinward in the asteroid belt.
Identity?
Scouts aren't that smart. We have images, though.
Show me the pictures. Images popped up on the holotank. I swiped my way through them until I came to one with part of a registration number. USE vessel, no question. I guess we can consider them accounted for. I looked through some of the other images. This isn't all vessel fragments. There's too much here. Can you identify the extra?
Auto factory equipment. And 2 to 3 vessels.
Ah, the USE ship was building copies and got attacked. I reflexively checked my telemetry. My money is on the Brazilian. I thought for a few moments. How are we on the general survey?
Resources scan 50% complete. Minimum resources have already been catalogued. System meets requirements for an auto factory.
Okay, so we can continue that when we have more time. Collect the scouts, and let's head for the rendezvous. It would take a day or so for the scouts to return to the Heaven 9, and 7 days for me to get to the midway point between Alpha Centauri A and B, where I would rendezvous with Heaven 10. I found Goku already waiting at the rendezvous. I tried hard to get Bob 10 to take the handle Hobbs, but Goku's response had been an unequivocal hell no, shading down from there as I continued to push. I'd finally given up, but I wasn't about to let the twerp think that all was forgiven. I opened a channel. Hey, Gherkin, miss me? Not from this range. Want to place a bet? Goku's tone was light, but I knew he was irritated because, well, I would have been. Bite me. Did you look over the pics I sent?
Yeah, interesting. Especially in light of what I found. Brazilian auto factory in full swing. 2 probes almost complete, 2 more about half done.
Crud. I examined the long-range pictures that Goku had just sent. So, I guess this is it. The group decision was just to go in swinging. Still okay with that? Goku sighed audibly.
Yes, I know you, we have ethical issues with that, but Medeiros has made his feelings on the subject very well known. As cliche as it sounds, the galaxy isn't big enough for both of us.
I closed my eyes and bowed my head for a moment. I'd always been a pacifist by choice, although I also accepted there was a point where you had to put up or shut up. The group consensus back in Epsilon Eridani was that unless Medeiros made some kind of peace overture, war had essentially been declared. I looked up at Goku's image in the holotank and nodded. Okay, then. Let's do this. We knew to within 1,000,000 kilometers or so how far away Medeiros would be able to pick up our reactor signatures. We would head outward to 50 AU from Alpha Centauri A, then turn and accelerate inward at 10G for as long as possible. We would then coast the rest of the way to the area of the Brazilian auto factory at close to 13% of the speed of light, separated by a few minutes to allow a staggered attack. At that speed, there would be no turning around for a second pass in any reasonable time. It took a week to get out to 50 AU, but only 5 days of straight acceleration to get into the Alpha Centauri A system. At a predetermined point, I ejected 2 scouts forward using the railgun. They would coast past the construction yard, a few 1,000 kilometers north of the ecliptic, gathering intelligence and beaming it back to us via laser link. As soon as the scouts were off, we cut off our drives, turned off our main reactors, and began to coast through the system toward the location of the Brazilian auto factory. I was in the lead position. At about 2 minutes before arrival, I felt that I had a good enough bead on the construction yard from telescopic survey and from the intelligence received from the scout. I activated my reactor and began peppering the area with cannonballs using my railgun. When I had run through most of my ammo, I ejected 4 busters with orders to go for the Brazilian probes. Then I went into a hard turn to northward. Medeiros had missiles, he might have railguns, and he might even have some equivalent of busters. Medeiros was not an engineer, but he was almost certainly career military. He'd have spent his life thinking of ways to destroy things, and the Brazilian military certainly would have supplied plans. As I accelerated at 10G into a new vector, I sent a short-range, high-amplitude sudar ping toward the yard. By this point, they almost certainly knew I was here, so the small possibility that I'd just alerted them wasn't worth considering. Sure enough, the yard was a beehive of frantic activity as the Brazilian equipment tried to move the new probes out of the way. One of the probes appeared to be moving under its own power, and 4 of something had just been launched in my direction. Presence of a reactor signature made it pretty clear that they were surge-powered, possibly buster-missile hybrids. I activated the surge jammer. Medeiros would be focused on me. Hopefully, he would assume that the jamming was a defensive tactic, and thus wouldn't notice Goku bringing up the rear until it was too late. The cannonballs that I had launched went through the construction yard like a shotgun blast. Visuals showed that 3 of the 4 probes were destroyed outright, along with most of the manufacturing equipment. And now came the surprise. Goku had kept his reactor off until the very last possible moment. He had also been able to piggyback off of my pings to get an accurate and up-to-the-second picture of the situation. As Goku barreled through just north and east of the yard, he sent cannonballs toward the 4th Brazilian vessel and the 4 missiles. I turned off the jamming in order to track the results. Goku took out 3 of the 4 missiles and trashed most of the rest of the construction yard, but the 4th Brazilian vessel was still under power. As I watched, it turned and made off in the opposite direction. Seeing that one missile was still in play, I launched 2 busters to rearward. Traveling as a pair, one behind the other, they engaged the missile. The Brazilian weapon managed to just dodge the first buster, only to meet the second head-on. There was a flash, and it was over. Goku and I applied the brakes at full power. It took 15 days to decelerate and then fly back to the location of the construction yard, while collecting the ejected scouts and surviving busters. We moved slowly through the yard looking for anything useful, anything still operational, and mostly any possible booby traps. After a thorough investigation at both short range and long range, we compared notes. One got away. No sign of it, no way to tell from this mess how complete it was. Goku nodded and brought up a schematic of the system. I've got drones doing sweeps, looking for reactor signatures or refined metal concentrations. Nothing so far. My bet is he'll leave the system. Too much chance of us catching him if he hangs around. If he has any sense, he'll be coasting on some random vector until he's too far away for us to detect him. I considered that for a few moments. Pretty sure he wasn't completed, otherwise he'd have been more active before we showed up. So, he may not have been stocked up with armaments or manufacturing equipment. If that's the case, he's essentially helpless. After a moment of silence, I changed the subject. What I don't get is that 4 probes were being built. That means that the probe that set this all up has already left. I frowned, trying to work through the implications. It also means that Medeiros left a disembodied copy of himself to run things with no protection.
Disembodied? Goku raised an eyebrow.
You know what I mean. Naked computer system, no ship. If we'd arrived a little sooner, it would have been like shooting fish in a barrel. Seems kind of cold-blooded to just leave them to fend for themselves.
Military mind. To Medeiros, everything is expendable, even other hymns.
Damn, I shuddered. Anyway, we own the system now. It doesn't look like the Brazilian plan includes a separate space station, or maybe that just comes later. How do you want to do this?
Goku put schematics of the A and B systems up on the holotank. B is good for manufacturing and not much else. A has a planet in the comfort zone, but I didn't get close enough to resolve it on my first pass. I guess we need to check that out, then report back to Bill.
Should we build some clones? Between A and B, there were more than enough resources for any number of Bobs.
I think we have to, Goku replied. We can't assume Medeiros won't be back. I doubt he'll take the loss well.
Do we build standard version 2 heavens or combat class?
Huh. Goku paused to think about that. Granted, our battleships take a lot more resources to build, but I'm inclined to go with combat class.
I agree, I replied. Let's send all this back to Bill. We might also want to consider doing everything in pairs from now on. Not just reconnaissance of suspect systems.
Uh-huh. Maybe you can make yourself a Hobbs.
And maybe you can make yourself a Dilbert.
Twerp.
Dweeb.
29. Riker, September 2157, Seoul. Negotiations were moving slowly. Colonel Butterworth necessarily had the welfare of his refugees as his top priority. But some of his demands did not sit well with me, such as his insistence that we not waste time searching for other pockets of humanity. Today's discussion had once again devolved into an argument about priorities.
If there are other refugees out there, they will communicate with you just as we did.
The colonel had his chin thrust out in what I'd come to recognize as his not-gonna-move expression. His British accent was becoming more clipped as the argument dragged on.
Why should we put effort into digging them out if they don't want to be dug out? It'll just slow us down.
Except that they may not have the equipment you do, or the familiarity with the heaven design, or they may not even be aware that we're here. I have a problem with just writing them off sight unseen, Colonel. I thrust my own chin out in response, hoping he'd get the unspoken message. No such luck.
It seems to me that your priorities should be clear, Riker. We are the proverbial bird in the hand. It does not make sense to risk our safety for the sake of some putative group that you don't yet even know exists."
I sighed, and with that comment we'd come full circle. Time to pull the plug. "Colonel, nothing has changed since last week when we had this same argument. Before I can build your colony ships, I have to build the shipyard. Before I can build the shipyard, I have to find the resources. Unfortunately, humans have mostly stripped the solar system bare, so there's going to be a lot of scavenging involved. That means I need more bobs, so that's the first thing I'm going to do." The colonel started to pace. I decided to do the same.
"Once the new bobs have helped with the setup, they will have some spare time to scan for other survivor groups. Yes, that will mean building some drones, but seriously, on the scale we are talking, that's chicken feed."
I stopped pacing and turned to face the screen squarely. "With all due respect, Colonel, at one point I did project management for a living. There's a critical path that gets us from here to completed colony ships, and the things you are so concerned about are not on the critical path. Looking for other survivors will not impact overall project duration." The colonel sighed heavily.
"And as usual, I concede that I am hat in hand in this situation, Riker. But I will continue to advocate for my people."
And with a final nod, he cut the connection.
"Well, that was fun."
Homer's grin had a little sympathy showing around the edges. I looked at his video image and gave him a weak smile in return. "Anytime you want to take over negotiations."
"Pfft, as if you'd let me."
Homer popped up a schematic of the solar system with several tool tips pointing to specific locations.
"Most of the drones and busters have reported in. There are a couple of promising locations and at least two out-and-out treasure hoards of available material. I should fly out to those to check them out before directing the mining drones to start taking them apart, just in case, you know."
I nodded. "And the remote stations?"
"No radio comms with anyone or anything outside of Mars orbit. Drones should be arriving at Titan soon. The Urt station will be a few days longer."
I gazed at the holographic images for a moment. "Thanks, Homer. I gotta say, you're being very professional in all this." He grinned at me.
"You mean as opposed to my usual self-imposed goal of driving you crazy?"
The grin disappeared.
"Each of us is different, Riker, but not different enough to not care. There are people out there, down there, that may die without our help. Any Bob that wouldn't care about that should have his plug pulled forthwith."
The grin returned.
"But don't worry, I'm saving up. Be afraid."
And with a salute that barely avoided being an obscene gesture, Homer's image disappeared. I shook my head with a smile. I fully believed his statements, especially the part about building up a backlog. I was surprised his head hadn't exploded by now. No, really. Homer had actually used that special effect on a couple of occasions, although admittedly not since he gave up the cartoon avatar. I brought up the tentative project plan that I'd put together. Colonel Butterworth's initial estimate of a decade was looking a bit optimistic these days. Right now we were about 5 steps back from where we could even get started on the colony ships. The first step was to find enough resources to get started on the second step. No point in worrying about it until Homer reported back. It took 20 more days for Homer to finish his survey. The large concentrations of refined material, wreckage from several space battles, were not quite as extensive as hoped, but still more than enough to get started. The drones had also reported back